writing craft book on your bedside table? Has it been there for a while?
Do you keep meaning to get past chapter 2, or chapter 1, or just the first page?
Then the Words to Write By podcast is for you. Hi, I'm Renee. I teach composition and creative writing to college students. My background is in poetry, but I'm working on my memoir.
And I'm Kim. I'm trained as a science journalist, but now I'm trying my hand at short fiction. Each week, we'll be tackling a chapter of some well-known, but perhaps not so well-read, writing craft book.
Together, we'll uncover brilliant insights, face the hard truths, and totally disagree when the author is wrong.
This is our podcast, after all.
And then, we're going to take what we learn and apply it to our own writing.
By doing the book's suggested exercises.
We're inviting you to read along, or just tune in for the Cliff Notes version.
We're committed to improving our own craft, one writing advice book at a time, and we'd love for you to join us. Hello and welcome to episode 5.
Exciting!
Yes!
We're on episode 5, moving right along.
We are. We are on chapter 5 of Gardner's book.
So, Kim, what words have you written this week?
Well, we launched the podcast last week, and so we had a whole bunch of emails that we sent out to people asking them to listen and review. All our friends and relatives who are listening, thanks for listening.
Thank you.
Technically, this one comes out 2 sessions after the official launch. So if you're still listening, it must be because you actually enjoy the podcast as opposed to just doing it for us. But if you're just doing it for us, thank you again for listening.
Thank you.
At this point, we are really trying to boost the visibility of the podcast. So we'll make this plea at the end of the podcast as well. But if you are enjoying this podcast, please subscribe. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts, a review would be so awesome. That could be your words that you write this week.
That could definitely be the words you write this week. That would be really helpful, everybody. I mean, you guys all know how Alice algorithms work. It's like when you get out of the gate, you really got to jump on it. So we would really appreciate it if you guys, and ladies, and anybody else,
yes,
jump in there and just say, hey, this was fun. I really enjoyed this. Or you could plagiarize what I just said.
That works too. Have you written anything this week, Renee?
Boy. I wrote show notes.
I'm liking the show notes. I like the further discussion.
Continuing the discussion.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was kind of an organic thing in the process of writing the show notes. In our first episode, we talked about the canon and what is the canon. I got kind of into that. And I wrote a few good paragraphs on it and did a little bit of research and then was inspired a little bit more, do a little bit more research. And then I got inspired to include that research and links on the website. And then the next episode show notes. And I went, huh, I could continue the discussion in this way. And then I went, huh, that's something I could do in every show note. So if you want to learn more, listener, go to the show notes and look at my handiwork. It's pretty good, I think.
And that's on each of our web pages. So you can either listen to this through the service you're listening, or you can go to our website and listen to them there. If you go to our website, you can read Renee's show notes. She's doing a great job.
Thank you.
And with that, on to the podcast.
On to the podcast.
On to the book. Today, we're discussing chapter 5 of John Gardner's book, The Art of Fiction, Common Errors. Gardner divides these into clumsy errors, of which we'll cover our favorites, and errors of the soul, sentimentality, frigidity, and mannerisms. And because we love Gardner so, we're going to try our own mannered writing, or purple prose, for the exercise. When you read reviews of Gardner's books in Goodreads and such, they say, well, there's kind of 2 halves to the book. There's the first that's more theoretical. I didn't get that much out of it. Comments about the sexism, all that sort of thing. But then often they become more positive about the second section, which they say has really good advice for beginner writers. So by all accounts, we should be more positive as we go along with reading his advice.
The advice becomes less theoretical and more practical, apparently. So we are tackling this with that in mind.
But this is Gardner, so he never leaves the theoretical too far behind.
Okay, so this chapter is called Common Errors. But there's one error to rule them all. All of these errors essentially do the same thing. The reason they are an error is because they break the reader's dream. They interrupt the suspended disbelief. Gardner says, the most important single notion in the theory of fiction I have outlined, essentially the traditional theory of our civilization's literature, is that of the vivid and continuous fictional dream. According to this notion, the writer sets up a dramatized action in which we are given the signals that make us quote-unquote see the setting, characters, and events. That is, he does not tell us about them in abstract terms, like an essayist, but gives us images that appeal to our senses, so that we seem to move among the characters, lean with them against the fictional walls, taste the fictional gazpacho, smell the fictional hyacinths. There's a dream that we're in. You're reading Harry Potter by the pool with a margarita and you're at Hogwarts in your head. If suddenly you're snapped out of that dream, it could be one of these common errors that did it. What do you think, Kim?
Yeah, I think that's the point of it. Whatever we're writing should be engaging enough for the reader that they give us their focus. But if we make certain errors, even though the overall ideas and concepts and everything's are very good, those errors can basically stop you up. It's like, you want to make sure all your parts of your car are running. The transmission may be working great and you might have a fantastic stereo and brand new tires, but if your brakes aren't working, you're going to get into problems.
Right. So like a few of the errors, if you go to the show notes, I'm going to go into a few. If you go on Patreon, you'll get all of them. All right.
Or you can read the book.
Or you could read the book. Who wants to do that? Right. So just a few. One is everyone knows the show don't tell rule. He says, insufficient detail. If you don't put enough detail in, the reader can't access the dream. That is what he would call a common error.
But he also has some more that are more particular, more interesting than that, because everybody will tell you the show don't tell.
Everyone will. He did cover that. But there are some that are more interesting than others.
What was your favorite common error that he brought up?
He does talk about this thing called shifts in diction or distracting diction. Mm-hmm. He says the writing has most of the usual qualities of falsely elevated diction, abstract language, cliche personification, Latinate language, where simple Anglo-Saxon would be preferable. So he essentially illuminates or illustrates in his own writing what distracting diction is, mm-hmm. which is really funny. Why don't you just say, trying to sound fancy distracts the reader. That would have just made so much more sense. But he has to say it in the most verbose way possible.
Did notice that in his descriptions. But part of his issue was the diction shifts. Like, if you choose a diction to stick with. But sometimes I've discovered the diction shifts work really well. I remember as a teenager running to some college student or whatever who was describing a restaurant. She said, the prices are exorbitant and the food tastes shitty. And I love that phrase because it mixes the two in.
Huh. Yeah.
Maybe he's talking about the prose part of itself, but if they're doing it intentionally.
On a general level, we're not even talking about novels, just talking about writing in general. I see it in the essays of my students. They will use this highly elevated tone, but then they'll put in something really odd. Like the author posits this idea, which is really cool. I'm like, whoa, you used posits and really cool in the same sentence? What is going on?
Well, the interesting thing, if you do shift diction, your reader is immediately focused on that diction shift. And so if you want to basically have them like laser focused on your words on the page, a diction shift is going to be noticeable.
And sometimes it's actually a cool stylistic choice. There's one book, I really love this book. It's called Earth Abides. It's a post-apocalyptic novel. It takes place in Oakland, in Berkeley. So for us, it's local. In the beginning, the main protagonist is a grad student. And he writes in kind of an elevated academic style. But as he ages through the book, the style mm-hmm. becomes more humble. And I thought that was clever. You know, being a grad student, you read a lot of graduate writing and you're like, oh, yeah.
I think the aspect here is to realize that if you do shift diction, everyone's going to notice. So you better be darn intentional about it. For the effect.
You are playing with fire. It's not that you can't play with fire.
People like you playing with fire, but you might get burned.
You might get burned. You don't want to get burned. If you get burned, it kind of ruins the show.
Yep, exactly. Yeah.
That was my error. It's a big error.
The one I liked was the infinite verb phrases. This is something that I did all the time. Can you give an example of what an infinite verb phrase is?
So a verbal phrase, infinitive, which gives the illusion that time is running infinitely. But an infinitive verb phrase is like saying, running to the store, comma, I picked up some apple juice. So that running to the store modifier in the beginning of the sentence, that is an introductory verbal phrase.
My original instructor pointed out to me is I used those kind of infinitive verb phrases or just introductory phrases. According to the notes on such and such, this is such the case. I would start with the verb phrase consistently through all my pieces. It was just was a way of loading extra information into a sentence as a science writer was something was easy to grab for. What I liked about his description was why it doesn't work. Like you said, it's an infinite phrase. It's something that's happening. The timing changes. Your reader is going along and they get the infinitive. They get the infinitive verb phrase and then they get present tense or whatever and it jars in their head.
I think on a technical issue, what happens is that it makes it seem like two things are happening at the same time when the reader can't do that. In real life, we can do two things at the same time. You can turn and shift your footing at the same time, but in the reader's mind, they need things one at a time. So when I said running to the store, I grabbed the milk. In the reader's brain, it looks like I'm both running
and grabbing the milk at the same time.
At the exact same time. And although that's not technically what the sentence is saying, and it is a grammatically correct sentence, it's just really confusing. But I am not a big proponent of avoiding doing grammatical stuff or combining sentences and all that stuff to avoid error. Do it and fix the error later. But if you're trying to avoid error, you do some other error that Gardner talks about, which is having the same kind of sentence over and over and over again.
Right.
So don't do that. Write your sentences the way you want to, but just go back and fix them later.
So he gives a whole example of clumsy writing. Like, it's a good checklist to go through and see if you're doing it in your writing. But then he, being Gardner, wants to move over to a different kind of error. Let us now turn to the three faults far graver than mere clumsiness. Not faults of techniques, but faults of soul.
The faults of the soul?
Sentimentality, frigidity, and mannerisms.
Yeah, these were interesting. Just remember, you guys, we're reading this so you don't have to. You're welcome. Let's focus on the first one, sentimentality. As Gardner states, sentimentality in all its forms is the attempt to get some effect without providing due cause. Emotion or feeling that rings false, usually because it is achieved by some form of cheating or exaggeration. So I took sentimentality to mean unearned emotion in writing. I don't think we see it very often because those writers are weeded out in the publication process.
I actually think that sentimentality is pretty rife within popular writing.
Really?
I think so. Like, anytime you put a child in danger, you're pulling on sentimentality there. You're stirring emotions in the readers from a situation where they are empathetically joining in.
But that's something that readers have to do in a book.
They do. To an extent, you kind of go to an author to give you that manipulation. So this is one of those weird things that happens, at least for me and several of my friends, is that once you have a kid, suddenly it's much harder to watch those episodes where children are put in danger. You've seen Finding Nemo, right?
Yeah.
You know, that opening scene is really hard to take as a parent. Before I had kids, it was just an exciting scene. It had a certain amount of emotion. But once you're actually invested in all your little children, it's suddenly really, really hard to watch.
Oh, man. Was it a genuine feeling you had?
It is. But part of the reason why it's a genuine feeling is because they're tweaking something inside me that's already there.
Is that sentimental? Now, what if they did something that was unearned? What if they wanted that reaction, but they didn't earn it? It sounds like they earned it. But can you give me an example of an emotion they want from you? They want something from you, and it's unearned.
Okay, let's go back. So the classic sentimentality is the Hallmark Christmas special.
Well, the classic sentimentality comes from the 17th and 18th century of the sentimental novel.
Okay, but it was intentional.
It was just kind of a byproduct of the time. The novel was new. You know, how do you get your reader to connect? People had a base understanding of how you connect with a person outside yourself, and you kind of relied on universal feelings.
So then here's the question. Is part of this a product of the environment? Is it a relative term? Is what we determine sentimentality now relative to our personal experiences and the world that we live in?
Yeah, I mean, everything written is a byproduct of the time in which it was written. I think it's changed meaning now. Sentimental writing in the past was like Pamela. It was this dude writing a narrative from the point of view of a maidservant woman who is continuously being accosted by her lord, trying to rape her throughout the whole book, and her protecting her virtue. And in the end, they get married. How ridiculous is that? Right? One, a servant girl becoming part of, like...
Oh, but that's classic fairy tale, right? The interesting thing is the fact that we then have to believe that she falls in love and wants to marry this guy.
Well, of course. Because he's got, well, money, but she's so virtuous. Man, that book was so popular. They had, like, Pamela Party. They had huge movements. People dressing up like Pamela. And it's like, dude, that is gross. But back then, it invoked something in people. But now, it wouldn't. Just think of something that has been unearned. You know, it makes me think of that example I give in my composition classes about pathos with Sarah McLachlan and the dogs. There's this SPCA commercial. It's rather long, and it's got Sarah McLachlan in it, and her song about the angels is playing in the background, and there's these slow, drawn-out montage of all of these animals that are disabled and just really, really sad situations. The first time I saw it, I cried. But now when I watch it, I'm like, oh, God.
Well, how about that? If there's something that each time you come to it, you get the same emotional hit, then if there's something true. But if it's something that you hit an emotional hit the first time, but by the second time you, or third time you see it, you're rolling your eyes.
Yeah, that would be a good litmus test for sentimentality.
If it actually continues to pluck at your heartstrings, or if after that initial hit, it doesn't do it anymore.
Yeah. Here's where it's applied to characters. Gardner, he says, once it is dramatically established that a character is worthy of our sympathy and love, the storyteller has every right, even the obligation, some would say, to give sharp focus to our grief at the misfortunes of that character by means of powerful, appropriate rhetoric. So it's almost like you are pushing an agenda in through the story. And Gardner says, if you've achieved a genuine connection, emotional connection between the character and the reader, then it's almost the obligation of the writer to actually make a point about it. Sometimes it could be a political point. It could be a point about the broader world, like poverty is sad. Murder is wrong. Things are bad. You impose a lesson.
But what he's saying here is if you've engaged the reader in this character, if they believe in that character fully and they can experience the emotions of that character, it's your obligation to tell a good story with it.
Yes. You can't just build this great character and then just let them lie.
So then moving along, we've got... You've got frigidity, which basically is the kind of the opposite, where the characters are going through something really horrible or horrific and you're not engaging in their emotions. Is that how you read it?
I thought it could mean frivolousness or like flippish disregard for the reader's investment in the story. You've created these really good scenarios or some like conflict or things that are going on. And maybe the reader's thinking, are they going to make it? And then you throw some wrench in there that just, it doesn't live up to what's happening in the story is how I took it. It was kind of weird because, again, I don't think I see examples of this very often.
I think it is more something like an action movie where the action hero is doing all this stuff. There's very emotions, but, you know, they're plowing through and doing all this stuff despite the fact that their best buddy just died. And they're not taking any time to grieve because they've got the bad guys and, you know.
I get it now. Yes, I get what frigidity is.
Yeah. You're throwing in plot to get stuff to happen, but then you're ignoring how real humans would feel at that plot. And I think the best use of this is the use of rape to move a plot along.
Yep.
Where it's a powerful experience. It's dramatic. It has, I mean, there are many stories out there that turn on the event of a rape. The story wouldn't be there if it weren't for the rape, but it becomes a shorthand. I need to get this woman to have a reason to be this way.
It's just a plot device.
It's a plot device.
Ew. Yeah. Do you think frigidity could be applied to like writing style? Could somebody's writing style ruin the story?
Well, I think science fiction sometimes falls in this category where they've got some very interesting technical plots and you're interested in seeing how it all comes out. And yet when you come right back to it, there was nothing about the main character that was engaging.
So it's just flat.
Yeah.
Just kind of falls flat.
Mm-hmm. Well, sentimentality shows up a lot in emotional stories.
Yeah.
And frigidity shows up in a lot of plot-based, often male written, but not necessarily.
I get it. Yeah. I can see the difference now between the two is one is emotional writing and one is more maybe action-based writing. Mm-hmm. And they both have similar errors, but they fail in different fronts.
Yeah.
I wonder why he's calling them failures of the soul. Seems a bit dramatic, don't you think?
He had that whole idea of connecting with your character.
Uh-huh.
Clumsy writing is technical issues. You can go through a paper and say, let's just rearrange these sentences and it's going to be fine. Or let's take out the passive voice or whatever. But if you created a male character that is not responding to all the stuff going around and that's your plot, like the soul of the piece is missing something.
So in sentimentality, it's the fault of the writer connecting emotionally with the reader. And frigidity is the fault of the writer not connecting emotionally or logically with the character.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's three parts. It's the author, the character, and the audience.
The rhetorical triangle.
There is a connection between the author and the character that is false. And the effect is that the audience notices it.
I see. Neat. Mm-hmm. This is a really fun discussion, by the way.
Yeah.
Who would have thought discussing errors would be so fun? Would you put darlings in this category of frigidity? Like when the writer gets in love with their own writing style and it's not even serving the story.
Would that mean more mannerisms?
Oh, maybe it is. Yes, you're probably right.
Okay, so the third thing he brings up, the third soul sin that he brings up.
The fault of the soul
is mannerisms.
Mannerisms!
And here, I've got to say, isn't this more of a stylistic choice of an era? Like, writing keeps changing. What we expect out of writing keeps changing. So obviously, if I were to write in style of the 1950s, it'd be completely mannered. But at the time they're writing it, it was the way to write.
Right, but if I want to read Shakespeare, I'm going to read Shakespeare. I'm going to read Othello. I'm going to read Hamlet. I'm going to read Midsummer Night's Dream. I don't want to read your version of it. I want to read a Shakespearean sonnet. I don't want to read your version of a Shakespearean sonnet. If I want the real thing, I'll go get it.
Are you saying only Shakespeare can write sonnets at this point? Or only the poetry of that time can be sonnets? Or could someone write a sonnet now?
No, writing in the voice of Shakespeare, using that old English style that he was writing in. We don't speak like that anymore.
Right, but if someone were to write a story set in the past and they used our current mannerisms speaking, would that work?
You know, one of the tricks I've read in other craft books, but it actually plays out, is if you want to use mannered writing, like say you want to write something from medieval times, you might start the character out speaking in what we would assume is how they spoke. Maybe a little more formal. You would use some of the terms of the time, my lord, and stuff like that. But then after you've established that language for a few lines, you actually slip into a more accessible language. Maybe not completely, but you do shift your diction just slightly so that a contemporary reader can slip into the story without being so distracted by the style. For example, there's a book on your shelf. I actually wrote it down in my notes. Called The Buried Giant by Kazuo Ishiguro.
Yes.
And I've read it.
Mm-hmm.
You've read it.
Mm-hmm.
And there was some criticism on it, and I adopt the criticism a little bit. He was writing a sequel to The Once and Future King,
mm-hmm.
and he adopted the mannerism of that book.
Mm-hmm.
And it distracted me a lot because it felt false, didn't feel real. You know, a 18-year-old college student trying to write a poem with the word forsooth in it is never going to ring true. I feel like with The Buried Giant, he's a contemporary writer trying to write like The Once and Future King, and it just didn't feel genuine. It was odd.
It was definitely odd. Do you think it would have worked if he used a more modern voice? There was a kind of a weird dreamlike sense to it all in a way that I couldn't quite make things out. His other works use a very plain language, and I'm not sure if he had used the same voice that he uses in some of those works, if it would have felt like a strange world where people were losing their memories.
I don't know.
What I'll say about that writer is that he uses very different diction in each of his novels. He is extremely aware of what he's doing, and he's not fumbling about. He chooses every word specifically for an effect.
Didn't he write Never Let Me Go?
Yeah, he Never Let Me Go.
Dear Lord, that book was amazing.
The language he used in that was just
precise. It was extremely precise.
Mm-hmm.
And it was so... Talk about earned emotion.
Mm-hmm. It did not have any flowery bits.
It made a lot of sense, though.
It was the language of a person who had been in her education system.
Yes, as I'm about to say, they were isolated and they were educated only up to a certain point.
Mm-hmm.
And they weren't meant to grow intellectually because they were meant to be body parts.
Mm-hmm.
And so what happens to the minds of people who are treated like body parts?
Mm-hmm. So he is a very mannered writer, and he takes on the mannerism. His most recent one is told from the perspective of an AI. And it also has some very interesting choices of words. It's consistent all the way through. you give that example of how to write a period piece where you start off being very mannerismed and then you jump back into a more common, accessible style. It's a good thing, but it basically means you don't really have a handle for how basically you're dialing up and dialing down as you go along, as opposed to being consistent.
Right.
You're jumping dictions. And if you're not doing it very carefully, you can have parts where you go very modern and then they have to reel yourself back and forth. One thing about the Barry Giant is it never stops being in that writing style.
Never breaks character.
It's a very dreamlike story.
It was a good story. I really enjoyed the story, but it was written in a strange style.
Mm-hmm.
I would forgive the characters for speaking that way, but the prose, the narrative style mm-hmm. in which the details were revealed, it never broke character. One could say that's a virtue, but it might be a fault. I don't know. But it got a little old. As I was reading it, I was like, all right, dude, I get it. I get what you're doing. Good job. I just want to reach my hand in and pull out the story. I just want to reach through the prose and not have any barriers. But that's a contemporary point of view. You know, you get used to things being told in a certain way. And when somebody breaks the mold a little bit and makes me think a little harder, sometimes I rebel. A lot of young writers, at least the ones I work with, they're struggling through the basics to figure things out because they're learning. And to avoid the struggle, they'll go to experimental lengths.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, well, I'm intending to be this way. I'm trying to be experimental. I'm like, that is awesome. I think that's great. But there's these basics that need to be taken care of. You can't experiment your way out of learning those things as much as you might like.
How about this take? I actually do agree with Gardner. I don't think as a young writer, you should start off writing a mannered piece because you need to be able to write in a clear way that is modern, stylistic sensibilities. You're going to have faults in your writing that you need to clear up. And if it's mannered on top of that, you're not going to be able to get into it. Just like you said, they'll say, I can't do it regularly. I'm doing experimental style to cover up all the faults. But it doesn't actually cover the faults. People can still see those faults.
Right. Now you not only have the fault of these basics, but now you also have this fault where you're not connecting to the reader with this experimental prose. If you're trying to drop in on a ramp with a skateboard when you've never jumped on a skateboard before.
Here's my theory. I think that Gardner includes the mannerisms as one of his big three ones that people should avoid because it's really hard for instructors to deal with the students where the writing is mannerized.
It's exhausting to read that kind of stuff. It's just more work. And also sometimes it is an ego thing. One easy way to sound smart is to slip into the passive voice, which is what my students do. It also ups the word count. Don't think I don't know what you're doing, but also playing with your margins. I can spot those a mile away. I think what they do is they'll slip into passive voice and that makes them sound fancier when they're just in the passive and it actually just annoys people.
I think we can come up with a very good reason for why teachers wouldn't want students to do mannerisms.
There's a theorist and a teacher that we used to read in graduate school for composition studies named Bartholomew, and he wrote an essay called Inventing the University. He talks about this phenomenon, which I see every single semester, where there's a couple of students who slip into passive voice and they slip into this highfalutin language that they think that professors want to hear. And they're playing to some audience. The problem is they don't know that audience. They don't know us yet. They are writing to an assumed fantasy audience that wants highfalutin, fancy-sounding language. They haven't read enough and they haven't written enough that they're even writing correctly. They're putting errors in because they're trying to sound smart. And it's like, you don't actually have the vocabulary yet to go there, even if you thought it was effective. So you've got this really weird writing. And when I read that writing, I get this sinking feeling in my stomach because half the time it's not easily fixable. Maybe this is why he says it's a fault of the soul, because it's not necessarily just a fault of grammatical error that is easily fixed. Sometimes I can go up to a student who's doing that and say, hey, you're writing in the passive voice. If there's a human agent in the sentence, make them the subject of the sentence. And it usually fixes itself. And the student goes, oh, I get it now. And I'm like, awesome. But then there's the other student who refuses, no matter how many times I tell them where to put their subjects or what their subject should be, refuses to do that because they say things like, I don't want to dumb it down for my reader. This is not a fault of grammar. This is a fault of ego. My young writer me would almost fight it, but then they kind of like that. They feel justified in it because the teacher doesn't like it. Somehow that kind of conflict spurs them on. Now I just give them that grade. I have a million papers to grade. I don't have time to parse through your language just to get to what I think your point is.
So all this talk about common errors, is there a good exercise in his book?
What to see, dear reader?
So on page 205, number 14, Gardner writes, write three acceptable examples of purple prose that is highly self-conscious and arty prose made acceptable by subject, periodic intent, voice, etc. So what he's asking you to do is to write in a purple prose style three pieces that are actually acceptable because of some deeper element. Renee and I don't want to write three different examples. So what we're going to do is we're each going to pick some purple prose or something that's highly mannerism, and we're going to write two pieces. And both are going to use the exact same style of writing. But one is going to be horrible dreck that nobody wants to read, and one is actually going to be meaningful.
So am I picking an example from a book and then riffing off that, or am I just making a really bad purple prose and then writing good purple prose in the same...
Your choice. I'm going to go and find some book because I find that if I read somebody else's style, it's easier for me to adopt that style.
I see.
And work from it. But if you have a particular purple prose style in your head that you can bat out, go for that.
Can I use Gardner?
You can totally use Gardner.
Because he is the master of purple prose.
Okay.
Purple prose.
Purple prose. Fun, I think. Maybe. Not so much. Would it be a good idea to do like a definition of purple prose for the listeners?
I did a look up on it and said it's a lot of use of adjectives, adverbs, and metaphors. And so when I was trying to write this, I said, well, how many adjectives, adverbs, and metaphors can I put into it? I have to admit that my purple prose is a lot less purple than Renee's purple prose.
I did a lot of purpling.
Yeah, you were much more impressive. That's kind of a humble brag sort of thing that, you know, I just can't seem to write purple prose. I'm just no good at it.
Well, I don't know. We need to read your example and then I'll let you know.
So what I did was I wrote a basic version of it and I tried to increase the purple prose randomly versus increasing the purple prose for a point.
Can you read purple prose and then the better version the second?
Okay.
All right, cool.
The chilling damp of the gray morning had gone precipitous, flooding the air with misty droplets so fine Matt hardly felt them amass on his face, cling to his glasses, and permeate his lightweight sweater. He thought longingly of his Gore-Tex jacket that hung in the dry closet next to the electric heater and the freshly brewed coffee. In front of him trotted Judd, stoic and oblivious to the way his feet squenched in the trail's loamy soil, leaving paw puddles. His boxy head kept tempo as muscles roiled beneath his tawny fur like a lion on a rain savanna. Every few yards, he'd pause and cock his head, contemplating the nearest bush or tree, like a man considering a piece of modern art. Behind him, Matt would watch with bated breath as the dog sniffed, lifted his tail, repositioned his legs, only to seem to lose interest and keep going deeper into the woods. Judd's fur must be soaked, judging from the liquid sheen on the turquoise carpet that hung on his stocky frame. Ashley had sewn herself when PetSmart's extra-large dog jacket hadn't been roomy enough. Judd's fur was too thin, his constitution too delicate to withstand the elements.
That was pretty good, actually.
This is my better version of it. The chilling damp of the gray morning had gone precipitous. A misty drizzle amassed on Matt's face, clung to his glasses, permeated his lightweight sweater, burrowed into his no longer young joints, soured his spirits. In front of him trotted Judd, feet sinking into the trail's loamy soil, leaving paw puddles in his wake. His boxy head swayed like a pendulum as muscles roiled beneath the tawny fur. Every few yards, his pace was slow, and a flicker of hope would rise in Matt's dark thoughts as the dog contemplated the nearest bush or tree, like a plebe pondering modern art. Behind Judd, Matt watched immobilized as the dog sniffed, shuffled his feet, lifted his tail, only to lose the plot and lumber on. Occasionally, he turned back and regarded Matt with soulful brown eyes as if to commiserate with him on the futility of the endeavor. Matt yanked the leash to keep Judd moving. They may both have been out in the elements on the orders of a woman, but Judd at least had the power to end their misery. The dog's fur must be soaked, judging from the liquid sheen coating the turquoise tarp that hung on his stocky frames. His jacket, Ashley had called it. She constructed herself when the PetSmart extra large line wasn't ruby enough for her darling. The way she went on about Judd's thin fur, his delicate disposition, you'd think Judd was a chihuahua, as opposed to the mastiff horse hybrid that hogged the apartment's couch.
Ha! You know, just looking at it right now, I really love how snarky Matt is, even though it's written in purple prose.
When I rewrote it, I was paying attention to all the phrasings, and I tried to give every single phrasing an edge to how much Matt did not like this dog. to analyze this. In the first paragraph of the two options, the first one, I had the extra sentence. He thought longingly of his Gore-Tex jacket that hung in the dry closet next to the delicate electric heater and freshly brewed coffee, which in my mind was emphasizing how miserable it was outside and how miserable he was being stuck out there. But in the other one, I just described the cold. It burrowed into his no longer young joints, soured his spirits. And I was trying to use the purple prose to evoke his character rather than just the elements that he was facing.
Right. And it's interesting because usually purple prose comes about a lot during descriptions, like overly heavy-handed descriptions. But this one actually includes, yeah, you're right, the character. This was written in, say, a whole long short story. What do you think the purpose of the purple prose would be for Matt?
It would emphasize his character and the fact that he didn't like this dog that belonged to his girlfriend. I would use it to layer, to give an extra layer of mood to the whole piece and sort of an editorial commentary that wouldn't be there if I just used description. When I read purple prose, it bothers me because it gets in the way of the actual story and I lose the thread. And here I was trying to make sure that all the purple prose hits you over the head with exactly how much Matt does not like this dog.
Well, I wonder, like, why is it written in purple prose?
Well, you've read a lot of my writing. I like descriptions and stuff, but I don't go very poetic. And I use this exercise as a chance to really dig in to this different style of writing to kind of push myself past my comfort boundary.
You say that you don't write ornate prose. So what kind of choices were you making when you wrote this?
A lot of it was like, how many adjectives and adverbs can I add? And more importantly, what kind of metaphors can I include in this? Because metaphors make things more poetic. Like when I was giving an example of the dog stopping, I had to come up with a metaphor for it. And I had something else the first time. I had like a man who trying to remember if he left the stove on, which kind of would give a pause, but it didn't quite register. So I worked around and came up with, someone looking at modern art.
I was going to mention, I like that metaphor.
The first time I did it, it was a man contemplating modern art. And then in the more opinionated version, I switched it to a plebe pondering modern art.
I liked it better without the plebe. Plebe seemed like it was pushing it further than it had to go. Although, is this guy just a sourpuss or is he obnoxious?
Yeah, I think that was the idea.
Plebe makes sense. If you did it again, would you do it differently? Would you write the story your way and then add all the stuff?
If I were to keep going on this, I would push myself to write in that florid style all the way through because it would give me the structure to build additional elements onto it. Like there was a paragraph here. Occasionally, he turned back and regarded Matt with soulful brown eyes as if to commiserate with him on the futility of the endeavor. Matt yanked the leash to keep Judd moving. They may both have been out in the elements on the orders of a woman, but Judd at least had the power to end their misery. And that whole paragraph came about because in the back of my mind was trying to think of how to work in the fact that Matt was not happy to be out there with the dog, to blame the dog for something. If I'm not actively including more hooks, it wouldn't come out.
Mm-hmm. After you've done this activity, if you were to give a writer some advice, would you say that they should try out purple prose or that they should avoid it?
I think you should try it. When my husband did art school, the students would say, well, I don't want to go any further on this piece. I don't want to overwork it. And he would say, the instructor would say, when you've overworked a piece, I'll let you know.
Ooh.
For me, I should try this in some of my own other writing just to see how far I can push the style, the upping, the richness of the writing. Because it's too easy to sort of stop and say, well, this is what I want to say and I don't want to say anymore. I don't want to be, overly emotional or too much.
But is purple prose the answer? I mean, what do you mean by that? By pushing it, does it push it into purple prose or does it push it in other ways?
I think people should find their voice when they're writing. And when a person finds their voice, it just raises the quality of their writing. When you start reading a person's work and there's a richness and a uniqueness and intentionality to the writing, you just know it. And the only way you're going to get there is if you push your writing. Sometimes you'll push it into purple prose, but you won't know until you go that far. A lot of stylized writing doesn't necessarily fit into purple prose. It's sort of an insult, like when it's gone too far. But a lot of successful writers have much more ornate styles.
Yeah. Yeah, and they're successful, and people like to read them.
And on that note, we're going to finish up this exercise. If you've really enjoyed Purple Prose and you want to hear Renee's take on Purple Prose, specifically what she thinks of Gardner's Purple Prose, then tune into our bonus episode on Patreon. Want to know more about Patreon? Here's Renee to tell you the details.
Okay, so if you subscribe to Patreon, you get lots of cool stuff. You're getting some cliff notes, chapter outlines, essentially, so you don't have to read the book. We did it for you. Another thing you get is an extension of this conversation. So we're going to go in a little bit more depth, you know, for workshop. And you get all that. Plus, you get it written down for you. So you'll get to read what we wrote and maybe even analyze a little bit. You can also comment in response, and you can do the activity yourself. And the first three people that do the activity will get feedback from me and Kim.
So check out our Patreon site and see what we got up there. You can find the link on our website page at wordstowritebypodcast.com. And for people that are just listening and enjoying our podcast, we would really love it if you subscribed on the Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts or wherever. Subscriptions are great. And if you could give us a ratings, we'd really appreciate that.
Part of starting a new podcast is getting people to listen to it. And we've actually been pretty successful. We're only doing episode 5 and we've got 200 downloads for our podcast. So we're so, so excited for that milestone. So if you have any friends that are writing, if you think that they would like this podcast, please send it to them. Be like, hey, I thought you'd like this podcast. And that would be really, really great for us.
Special thanks to Stump Post Stump, who posted a review of our podcast in Apple Podcasts. We actually don't know who you are, but we thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
Next week, we are going to be moving on to a chapter that Gardner calls Technique. We haven't read the chapter yet, but this is what it promises. What the young writer needs to develop to achieve his goal of becoming a great artist is not a set of aesthetic laws, but artistic mastery. So we are going to learn all about artistic mastery from Gardner in our next episode.
Dun, dun, dun.
Tune in.
Words to Write By is produced by Renee Nelson and Kim Smith-Adam. Our theme music is Roll Back the Carpet by Cool Cat Music. Have a great day.
Example, has anyone seen who else is here? Who else